Today is November the 1st, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key in the studio of the Progressive Radio Network. My colleague is Joe King, and he's on remote tonight. Podcasts of this program is available on PRN.FM, and our website is PCRadioShow.org. WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and we have been preempted with a replacement program. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Hank. Thanks very much. Did you go to the parade yesterday?
No. In fact, with what happened yesterday, that was very dramatic, and I just felt very bad that, you know, that incident took place.
Because I felt bad for the people who were killed and wounded by that crazy person, but the parade went on, and some of my friends actually went down to it and announced to me that everything was normal, so therefore the terrorist failed in his purpose because the people continued being the people that they would be.
Well, you know, among the injured, and I think at least one killed, was, you know, Stuyvesant High Schoolers, and I really feel bad for the kids. I'm can you imagine going back to class today and you don't know what to expect? Really,
it was really terrifying for the high school kids. I really felt very, very bad for those visitors to this country from Argentina. They were not.
We had visitors visiting New York that got killed too. I don't know. You know, we were told that the end of October 31st, was going to be a big, big corporate announcement by Sprint and T-Mobile, and I was looking forward to the announcement, and yes, they made a big announcement. I thought it was like the big merger. There was no merger. They're announcing that there's no merger. And
well, that was a big announcement.
Now, wait a minute. A year ago, I know that SoftBank, which owns Sprint, was in talks with T-Mobile, which is owned by Deutsche Telekom, about taking over T-Mobile, and then somehow that fell apart. And with T-Mobile, they really have been very aggressive, and they've really done really tremendous growth in the 1 year. And I think that they have made a difference in the wireless area. And then,
I got to ask you a question, though. I understand all of that is wonderful for T-Mobile and wonderful for SoftBank. Do you think it's really appropriate that key elements of our infrastructure should be owned by foreign governments?
Well, I think that you're not going to be able to separate everything from as being not from a certain country, because you got component parts. You have.
I'm not talking about component parts. I'm talking about the entity of Japan and the entity of Germany. Ironically, are taking over our communication networks.
Well, let me put it this way: there is competition.
I wouldn't care if it was Great Britain and Canada. I don't think it's sensible to allow key elements of any country's infrastructure to be owned by another country.
Well, if you feel that way about it, you could always say, "I'm not going to be a customer." And if many other people were saying the same thing, they will no longer be able to do business in this country because there's no business.
Well, one of the interesting things I've always found about our country is we treasure our freedoms tremendously, so much that we would never do anything to impinge on the individual's freedom. And there are many, 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 I wouldn't even say a huge majority, I would say most Americans would not give up something that they wanted simply for national security.
Well, we do. We do. Have you been to the airport recently where many people have to take off their shoes? They have to do, I mean, that's giving up sort of like privacy and freedom. You mean I got to take my shoes off?
It's given up nothing. It's talk, all talk.
And if they ask you to take off your shoes, well, by the way, in your case, you don't have to take it off because if you're over 75, you know.
Is that true?
Yes. If you're under 2 years of age, you don't have to take it off, and if you're over the age of 75, you don't have to take off your shoes. And in your case, you're many years above 75. Don't worry about it.
And in both cases, for the same reason. For the two-year-old or for me, it's so hard to tie those laces.
It's not tying the laces. I remember when my grandchildren were flying, it's trying to get the shoe off and getting it back on again.
It's funny. The last time I flew, which was this past summer, in the end of the aisle, when you're getting into going through the gate and everything, there's always a box that the transportation safety officers fill up with little items that are left behind after the inspection. And there was a pair of children's shoes. Everybody stopped and looked at it.
Well, you know why? Because if a kid is crying, you pick up the kid because you got the pressure, the peer pressure of some person behind you wanting you to move. And you know, you're trying to take care of the kid and you just forget to pick up some of this stuff. But let's get back to this Sprint and T-Mobile. You think it's a good thing that they don't merge, or you really like to see them emerge?
First of all, I was opposed when Deutsche Telekom bought T-Mobile. I was even more opposed when SoftBank, which is a Japanese company, bought Sprint. So there you're starting with two companies that I don't think should have been purchased. Whether or not they merged, I would say it's good for the people if they don't merge. You have more competition. But in this case, I think it's bad for the people no matter what they do.
Well, if you think about it, in the past 1 year, T-Mobile has made a difference in cost to the consumer because of what they've done on unlimited minutes.
Again, if I'm not going to think about the importance to our country of the infrastructure, T-Mobile is probably the most consumer-friendly communications company out there. If they're not counting who owns them, I would seriously consider switching from Verizon just for the financial point. But that's my point. Everybody looks just for the financial point, not for the good of the country.
Well, I think that, first of all, T-Mobile and Sprint were on the ropes to begin with. So you had these two companies from a different country, you know, bailing them out. And I've seen some bailouts from a foreign country, and it doesn't help at all. You remember Lucent? Lucent, Alcatel came in. You know, that's another telephone company, and it didn't help Lucent at all. It just, you know, went under. So... and then it also works in reverse, too. We've had American companies pick up foreign telephone companies like Nokia. And then as soon as Microsoft picked them up, they said, forget about it. We're going to drop them. So in this kind of business, it's crazy.
Now,
it's,
that's different there. You're not talking about communications.
Well, that was the phone, okay?
That was a piece of hardware. Now, there are times that I am opposed to hardware also, but in this case, I don't think it had any national security implication.
Well, do you have some concerns about the Japanese or the Germans?
I have concerns about the infrastructure of any company, of any country, being owned by another country. It jeopardizes the security and the sovereignty of that country.
Well, I don't think we can add any more to this, so that we'll just have to watch and see what these two companies do and whether it gets absorbed by some other company, or they actually do get absorbed, or they just continue to thrive, or they die in the vine. We'll see what happens.
I don't think they can die on the vine. I don't think other places would allow that to happen. I think that I've made my feeling well known. I am quite sure I will hear from a majority of our listeners that I'm all wet, and I accept the criticism, but I still feel that way.
Well, we have to be upfront with the listeners that to say that you are not a T-Mobile, you are not a Sprint customer. I happen to be a T-Mobile customer, and you're a Verizon customer, so everyone understands where we sit, right? Joe?
Indeed.
Yeah. Joe, you know, there was a surprise announcement from Microsoft, and it's... pretty cute what they're doing. Now, with Microsoft, there's confusion. I know when I talk to people who are really on the consumer market and they are not working for big companies. Because with big companies, when you buy Microsoft Office, you buy the Office copy, which includes everything, which includes Outlook And when you just buy the regular student copy, there's Outlook Express, and they think Outlook Express is the same as Outlook. It's not. It's very different. And Microsoft has deliberately done that to sort of like, you know, they give you something that it really isn't, but if you want the real thing, you got to go for the big package. Well, Microsoft is using Outlook, and I call it as a to bootstrap into something different. And what they have announced is that Outlook will be a free product, but it will no longer be supported or sold separately. It'll be free with the Office 365 Enterprise version.
Sorry, calling it free is such a misnomer. It is no way that it's free.
Well, they're not going to charge for it. It's going to be included in...
They're not going to charge additional for it, but you have to buy Office 365 to get it.
And why are they doing this? Because they want to get people to switch from a license product where you pay a one-time fee for the license and go into the software as a service product. In other words, a rental product.
Again, software as a service is a great misnomer because service is a very positive word. This is more properly called rent a software or lease a software. You don't own it. You can use it as long as you keep paying every month.
Well, but the thing is, they use a single digit. They say, well, it's only $8, $9 a month. I mean, like, that's, you know, actually... I've seen an independent advertise saying that you can use you can run Office 365 for less than a cost for a pack of cigarettes a month.
I don't smoke.
No more. I know you're really against smoking now. Hey, by the way, did you hear about the new law in New York City on vaping?
Vaping.
In other words, electronic cigarette. They treat the electronic cigarette the same as a regular cigarette, and if cigarette smoking is not allowed, vaping is not allowed.
That seems very reasonable to me.
I know. I've been in the company of someone who was using electronic cigarette, and the smoke was even worse because he's sucking it in harder and blowing it out with greater force, and I said, wow, I can't take it anymore. I had to walk away from it.
Smoke. It's as they call it, vapor. But more important, that they have been zero published tests on how safe it is. Not only how safe it is for the person who's inhaling the chemical, but how safe it is for the people standing next to him who are getting the secondhand vapor. We know now that secondhand smoke is just about as dangerous as smoke from cigarettes, pipes, cigars, etc. I just don't understand. In this country, we have so many rules about things that are personal and shouldn't be involved in rules, medical rules and things like that, and we have no rules regarding an object whose sole purpose is to kill.
Well... let's put it this way. Microsoft is now, I think they're going to slowly move almost all of their software into software as a service, in other words, as a rental item. And
when you say they're going to rent the Outlook as part of a larger package that they're renting, what about all of those people who are now using it, having bought it for cash money?
No problem at all now. If they want updates, they have to go to the new version. The new version happens to be called Office 365.
Well, here's a piece of advice that I will not give, but I will say, and you'll have to figure out whether it's appropriate or not. I still run Office, I believe it's 2010.
It works fine.
It comes with all of the things that I need, and also comes with a whole bunch of things I don't need. And I will, if they're telling me that I cannot update that to 2017, fine, I'll stay with 2010. I never went up to anything over that anyway.
Well, you know, Microsoft had something similar to this way back, and I laughed because people were falling for it. I remember they had Office 95, which really, for most people, is all they really need. They've been adding a whole lot of whistles and bells, and 80% of it, no one ever has even know what the use is. So when they announce Office XP, everyone assumes that you need an XP to run it. Not true at all. Everyone assumes that with Office XP, it supersedes and you can't run Office 95. Not true at all. So they attach these numbers or letters to it to imply that you have to upgrade. And Joe, yes, you're right. You can run Office 2010, 2013, no problem at all. You can continue to run it. And considering what the advantages of with these new features, you never heard of it.
Well, I don't use most of the features. Like most people who use Office, I use about 10 or 15% of what's available in Office. The only advantage to updating Office is every so often Microsoft admits that there are some really bad security holes in their software, and they don't always update them for older programs. When they do, fine, I have no problem. If they don't, I understand that you can't keep updating an old product forever, and you might have to buy a new one. But now they're saying, no, you don't have to buy a new one. You don't have to pay all that money. You can just pay three times as much money on the rental plan.
Well, you have to understand that some of these updates, they realize that most people don't need the updates. Most people don't even use most of the features in Office. So one of the upgrades that they sneak in, okay, is remember Office Word is .doc, and then they came up with a new format, .docx. Oh, you mean for me to read a .docx file, I need a new version?
No, actually you don't. They
I know you don't, but they implied it, though.
And then they got so much flashback that they made a reader for the DocX. They made a reader available free online. You could download it to your own machine without updating Office, and it would, in essence, translate the DocX headers and whatever else was necessary so that you could make it a usable product. I've had so much trouble with that with different machines. If it's my machine, I know I've got the readers on it. But when I'm at somebody else's machine or at the library, I'm not sure that they're always updated. And you, for some reason, I think simply to aggravate me, always send out DocX files.
Now, Joe, it's just that you say, I need it right away. You didn't let me convert it into a PDF. So you want it right away, I'll give it to you the way I have it.
Well, why don't you give it to me in Chinese?
You know what? You're going to be sorry you said that. Hey, Joe, there's one thing that I really do want to cover, okay? And that's iOS. There is a security researcher has uncovered a major privacy loophole in Apple's mobile software, iOS, and that has to do with a camera. And when I told you about it, you said, wow, because your wife has an iPhone. And if you were to say, okay, I'll buy a new iPhone, but they still have to fix it, and a new iPhone does not have 5 LTE support.
Well, a lot of people don't know what that is, but I think you should finish talking about the security feature that you began, because once you told me about it, of course, I went in to read as much about it as I could, and I found it's considerably worse than you told me it was, Hank.
Go ahead. I want to hear your interpretation of it.
Everything you told me about the camera is true. That is, once you access the camera with an application in your iPhone, every other application now has access to that camera. They don't turn it off. But what I didn't know is the same thing is true with the microphone. So that now every other program can listen to and record and send out anything that's said in the room, provided it's close enough to the microphone. It's a wide open mic with a wide open camera. Talk to me about security breaches. That one is ridiculous. And I only heard about it because you told me about it.
Well, I think it's for most people, it's under the radar, because when I mentioned it to a few people with iPhones, they said, nah, come on, Apple has a better product than that.
Well, I said, I went closer than that, and I said to my wife, do you want me to put a Band-Aid over your
to cover camera? The camera, right.
She said, what are you talking about? And I told her, and she said, don't worry about it. I do worry about it. Oh. And now that I found out it's the microphone as well, I'm not sure if a Band-Aid over the microphone would help.
Well, and also the camera. And we have to tell people that if you buy the iPhone 8 or the iPhone 10, it does not have the hardware for 5 LTE communication.
Could you tell us what that is?
It's a much higher speed communication for cellular phones, and that's where the technology is moving. It's in the wireless area. And the speed difference is a whole magnitude difference.
We were talking a few minutes ago about two telephone companies that were thinking of merging. How does that affect them?
Well, T-Mobile was the one that won the spectrum for 5 LTE, and the FCC gave them 2 years to implement it. And everyone, or some of the manufacturers like Apple, said, 2 years, you know what, we'll have a new model out. So, you know, after the 8, after the 10, we'll just have another one that will be 5 LTE. And some of the other vendors or manufacturers, such as LG and Samsung, they do have some models that are 5 LTE compliant. And to the surprise of everyone, instead of taking 2 years to implement 5 LTE, technology, what T-Mobile did was they partnered with Qualcomm to do it in hardware, and they had it up and running by this summer. In other words, it took them 6 months to get it up and running, where everyone thought it would take 2 years. It took everyone by surprise.
Well, if I walk into a T-Mobile store tomorrow morning and I want a T-Mobile account, but I tell them I only want it if I can use the T-Mobile emitters, which are on a 5 LTE. Would they be able to give me the account with a phone that works?
Well, I don't know if they can give you the phone, but they can. You could probably go online or ask an authorized dealer what phones are compliant with 5 LTE, because they're rolling it out this month. Because they said the rollout for 5 LTE was in November, and we're into first day of November now.
But you're saying to me that my Pixel 2, I have a Pixel 1, may not work on that network?
Your Pixel does not have the hardware for 5 LTE. It's a piece of hardware that has to be built in.
And so it's not upgradable either. You're just saying my phone is...
Well, you know what? When you say upgradable, I know that as a general rule, people like you to... buy a new product, but sometimes a product is so expensive, they say it's upgradable. I mean, you remember Leica as a camera manufacturer?
Mm-hmm.
I was able to upgrade the camera, from one model to another. Of course, the upgrade was not cheap, but the cost of the upgrade was still cheaper than buying a new camera. So now Leica is very different because it's such a high-cost item. They made things upgradable, but that's not necessarily true with a lot of the cell phones, because everyone, it's a two-year item.
My cell phone is expensive, and the new Apple X is extremely expensive. And if they're not upgradable, it means that how soon is this 5 LTE going to be taking over?
It's not a question of taking over. It's a question of, do you need it? Do you want it? And if you want it, then you have to pay for it. It's like anything else. It's like, we have the autonomous car coming out soon. If you really want to have an autonomous car, you'll pay for it. But you say, look, I don't really need it. I could use my old, junkyard crate, and I'm happy with it. So it all depends.
I don't want to change the subject for a minute, but then I want to talk about that again. But do I need the 5 LTE? I've got a Pixel. I've got Verizon as my carrier. Do I need 5 LTE compatibility?
I would say that if you're using your cell phone as an all-around thing, which includes Netflix viewing, which includes HBO and so on, you probably would like to have it, okay? Because the you want to be able to watch a film as soon as you ask for it, instead of waiting for it to be downloaded and then wait until it's completed for the download to start viewing it. Joe, you know what I'm going to do? I am going to move on and just let the people know what we're going to have for the second half hour. The second half hour, I touch on two items, and they're all related to what's coming up very soon. That's called Black Friday or Cyber Monday, and some of the things that you should be aware of, because I have two pieces of advice for Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Don't worry about not getting that deal on electronics, because if you miss that deal, it will always be cheaper later on. Number two is, you have to ask yourself a big question. Do you really need it? A lot of people say, wow, look at the price on that. They buy it, and some people never get to it. So let's get to the second half of the show. For the second half hour, we have some very interesting feature segments. I will be talking about how are you going to squeeze in what you need on a 32 gigabyte storage system and yet still have enough space to work with. Dr. Alfred Paul will be presenting his wearable and health technology segment, and he will be covering common smartphone apps can save heart attack patients. Another segment is smart hard hat helps workers in emergencies. And finally, he's going to be talking about California hospital system offers patients access with an Apple app. I have a segment that I will be doing. Hidden partition has been evolving where it's not what you think it is anymore. Marty Winston will be talking about his Raspberry Pi using MySQL Red Hat Supermicro. That should be quite interesting. How to squeeze the most into a Windows 10 32 gigabyte storage system. Low-end Windows 10 notebooks cost the same now as a low-cost Chromebook selling for under $180. I expect that prices for these systems on Black Friday and Cyber Monday will be selling for under $100. A Windows 10 system is more versatile than a Chromebook notebook. These systems equipped with 32 gigabyte of flash card storage is limiting though. The memory modules are soldered onto the motherboard, so upgrade is not possible. The eMMC flash storage is also soldered onto the motherboard. I've been using this 11.2-inch screen system on travel. Primary usage is internet access. The processing speed was acceptable. With patience, I have even done audio editing on the unit. Why a Windows 10 unit instead of a Chromebook? Well, on a Chromebook, there is no tax preparation program available. For me, that was a big difference factor, and that influenced my choice. Of course, all that will not matter if the tax reform enables 80% of filers to do it on a postcard, but I'm not holding my breath. I bought a low-cost Windows 10 notebook that listed for $200 for under $100 last year. The same unit is available today, and I expect that notebook to sell for under $100. And that notebook sells today for under $180. With 32 gigabyte of storage capacity, the actual usable storage after initialization was about 6 gigabytes. There are a couple of things you can do to increase storage availability. Enable compression on the disk drive. That raises the total available storage to 8 gigabytes. There's a little slowdown as compressed files need to be expanded, but I was pleasantly surprised that the slow speed for the work I was doing was not a big factor at all. Installation of a 64 gigabyte micro SD card can be used to the operating system advantage. Make sure the flash card has a 10 rating. I redirected the Windows folders, documents, and downloads to the flash card. Now that I was on a roll to squeeze as much as I can from a 32 gigabyte storage system, I opted to load and run many portable applications. A portable application can reside on the flash card. Since it is portable, there's no linkage with Windows registries. By the way, registries is a fancy term used by Microsoft for operating parameters. The operating parameters for portable apps are self-contained within the application. The Microsoft concept of registry is to enable collaboration with other users. I feel strongly that the number of home PC users don't do much collaboration with other members in the family. Portable apps don't need to be installed and can be simply copied them to the folder for use and to be run. And to remove a portable app, just simply delete the files. Since Microsoft Edge is part of the OS, the browser is built in. However, I like Opera, and there's a portable copy of Opera available for the use as a browser. There is also a portable OpenOffice application. If, however, you really want an office that is more like Microsoft Office, that is to say, Microsoft Office, well, there's Google Docs, and if you insist on 100% Microsoft compliance, there's always Microsoft Office 365, of course, for charge. There are a number of programs available that are portable apps. There's over 600 of them that I found in snapfiles.com, and you could easily do a search by saying, download portable apps, and you'll find many more. And if you don't find a portable app that meets your needs, well, you can always take the regular application and store it and run it on the available flash storage.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Did you know that a common smartphone application could save lives? Well, that's the message coming out of Buenos Aires, of all places, in Argentina. They did a study and followed cardiac arrest patients from 2012 to 2016. One of the groups rode in ambulances where the emergency medical staff had been given smartphones running the WhatsApp application. It's a common social media communications program. And they found that when the paramedics on the ambulance were able to send ECG and other heart information about the patient ahead to the hospital where the cardiologist could review it in advance, they found that on many occasions, the patients could bypass the emergency room screening altogether and go straight to the cardiac catheter labs. This actually shaved off nearly a full hour between the time of the onset of the attack and when they finally received treatment. And this has an enormous potential for saving lives. So, you know, no fancy telecommunications equipment, no high-powered devices installed in the ambulances. It was just a plain old smartphone running a common application, and this was able to have a significant impact on the outcomes for these patients with heart attacks. You're deep in a mine, and the power goes out, and there's toxic gases leaking, and they block your normal escape path. What are you going to do? If you're MacGyver, you'll come up with some fancy solution on your own. But if you're lucky enough to be wearing a new technology device called the guard hat, you may be able to get out of the situation safely and quickly. The guard hat is actually a bit of wearable technology. It's a special hard hat that has sensors and two-way communications devices in it. What happens is when a worker gets into an emergency situation, people back in a control room can see what they're seeing. They can locate them using geolocation services, so they can pinpoint their position. They can monitor some of the environmental factors around them and monitor some of the factors of the individual wearing it themselves. And so this gives them a whole lot of information, and then they can actually talk to the worker through the hard hat and give them instructions, such as in this mining example, they can direct them to alternate routes that are going to give them a route to safety. Some of the other ways that the device can be helpful, for example, is that, say, a worker suffers a fall and gets injured, the hat will automatically detect the fall and notify emergency personnel and summon help for the worker. So here's a case where a fairly simple device could save lives and a lot of money for businesses where workers work in dangerous situations. Unless you're a Red Sox baseball fan, you're probably still looking for the killer app for an Apple Watch. Well, there's a novel app that's being developed out by Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, and they've actually come up with a health tech program for an Apple Watch that looks like it could be very helpful. Basically, what this new app It's an extension of the app that they've already created for patients for their smartphones. On their smartphones, patients can access their medical data. They can find the locations of the nearest hospital or urgent care center. They can even communicate with their doctors. Well, those same functions are now available through the Apple Watch, which makes it convenient. You can access the watch in an emergency to find the nearest healthcare center. You can input user-generated data from your fitness device or your blood sugar monitor or other devices, and you can even set up communications directly with a doctor if you need to contact them. So the whole point of this for me is that it's a movement to put patients more directly in touch with their own medical records and treatment process, and also to lower the threshold of energy it requires to reach out and contact a healthcare professional when you need information or treatment. We know that the sooner many illnesses are treated, the more likely you're going to have a good outcome, the lower the treatment costs will be, and the better quality of life for the patient. Anything that makes it easier for patients to get good information quickly could, in the long run, save a lot of money and save a lot of lives. Here's an application for the Apple Watch that just may be a lifesaver. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
The evolving original copy of the Windows operating system. When you initially turn on your brand new Windows 10 PC, you first have to initialize your system user profile. At its completion, you should do an image copy of the entire operating system and its environment. You may ask if there's a hidden partition containing the operating system. Why do you need to do this to run this process? Well, the hidden partition today has evolved where it is in most cases just a skeletal operating system. With many low-cost systems sold today, it has only 32 gigabytes of memory storage. This has created a major constraint with having the factory distributed OS in the hidden partition. Many only have a skeletal part of the operating system, and you need internet access to complete the installation process. A system image is a backup that contains everything stored on your computer, including the full installation of Windows 10, settings, applications, and all your files, as well as any additional drives you may have connected to it. If your computer fails, you can use a system image backup to restore your computer to be up and running in a short period of time on the same or different storage drive. It's not the question of if, but when. Sooner or later, the hard drive or solid-state drive or memory storage drive on your computer will fail. Solid-state computer is very reliable, and it's more likely you will eventually have to deal with malware. Malware may take control of your system via social engineering, or a critical parity error may have corrupted your data and/or operating system. If you don't make regular backups, you could lose important documents, irreplaceable pictures, and settings that you may have spent hours configuring on your device. The operating system can easily write an image copy of the hidden partition onto a 64 gigabyte USB drive or SD flash memory card, and a system image backup is basically an exact copy image of a drive. And in other words, you can use a system image to completely restore your computer settings and or in the event of a PC disaster. You can use Windows 10 to create a system image. Just do a search on the following string of words: how to create a system image in Windows 10. And it'll generate a number of locations you can go to for detailed instructions. The alternative to this is to do a factory reset from the hidden partition. A common problem encountered by many on a PC is the insertion of malware via social engineering. Instead of spending a great deal of time to identify, isolate, and fix the problem, try doing a system restore back to a point before the problem. If the malware damage cannot be fixed, or if you have lost confidence in the integrity of the system, you can do a factory reset with the option of retaining the user data that you have, or to do a complete cleanup of the drive and reinstallation of the operating system, And in both cases, you will need to reinstall the applications. Another common problem encountered by many on their PC is the OS is sluggish, or it hangs up, or you've got the dreaded blue screen of death, and it popped up on the screen. The most probable cause is that there is a memory parity error or a transmission error during a Windows update transmission problem. This is a long-running conversation I have had with many of the industry leaders about the need for memory parity on consumer systems. The argument why it was removed from consumer systems is that loss of parity error only happens once in a blue moon. But then why is it that enterprise systems are equipped with memory parity? Hey, what's good for them is good for me too.
I haven't yet updated 40yearhouse.com to explain why it's now going to be a cybernetic house in its design. So we'll get a little bit geekier than usual here, but I think I can touch on the elements in a way that makes sense. Any automation system tends to have sensors, which may be virtual or real. It tends to have a controller. It tends to have actuators. Sensors are the conditional things that the controller reads and interprets into actions. In our environment, there's almost 100 of those, arranged as nodes on a network, a fairly flat network. So there's intelligence, a Raspberry Pi at a minimum at each node, that is taking a look at what the sensors are reporting and deciding what to do with the actuators. But they're not working alone. They're working in conjunction with information from all the others. And the reason that happens is that everything that represents what you might call news, a change in status on one or more of the sensors, a change in status that's derived from something in its environment, everything that it would consider news, you would consider news, it reports to a central SQL database. SQL stands for Structured Query Language, and in the back halls of technical schools, it's often referred to as SQL. SQL is proper, SQL is popular. You know the difference. One of the biggest standards, one of the best of the implementations of an SQL database is MySQL, or MySQL. We'll call it either one, depending on what moves us at the moment. And it is something that we want to run on Linux for reasons I'll get into momentarily. In looking at MySQL databases, one of the things we wanted to avoid was getting into a circumstance where there were frequent updates, and that does not seem to be a danger. Now, I'm speaking about updates to the software itself. Updates were also a reason to go with Red Hat Linux Developer Edition, which updates maybe once a year. Now, every time there's an update, you may have to take the thing down, bring it back up again. It's not a long interruption, but it's an interruption, and we try to avoid interruptions to a continuously operating core on the system. All right, so what are we doing with MySQL or any SQL database? What we're doing is recording those significant news events from each of the nodes and then letting any of the nodes aggregate news from, and status, I might add, from the collection of all other relevant nodes. If I wanted to know where people are in a house, I have to collect at least 30 different nodes to know that. And any node can find that out just by asking. Structured query language. If you use Visual Basic for applications, you may have encountered it. If you are using Microsoft Access, you may have encountered it. Structured query language is a way to use something very near to plain language to determine for specific items in specific, well, we'll call them containers and specific events, whatever situation you wanted to stipulate. And it's like, okay, which girl is the redhead with the purple lipstick? Which guy has the banjo that has a tear in the whatever? It's able to do that kind of thing, but much, much, much broader, deeper, more specific. Needle in a haystack is child's play for a good relational database. And these MySQL databases are relational databases. Okay, well, we've got Raspberry Pis everywhere, and all of them could go calling on the MySQL database for information at any millisecond. So what are we going to run that on? And I thought initially, okay, we'll just let another Raspberry Pi be the server for it, but no. I wanted to do better than that, so we went to Supermicro, and we're talking to them about a very, very, very nice server for it, one that can run that Red Hat Linux distribution, one with 8 drives in a RAID 6 array, so there's a lot of redundancy, a lot of failures have to happen before that drive array is down, plenty of RAM, dual redundant power supplies. Talk about backup, Hank. That's power supplies to back themselves up. And some other performance features that very, very plainly, very candidly, I will tell you, are deliberate overkill. We can undercrank and probably will undercrank the Xeon processor on this, because when you undercrank a processor, you reduce the heat. When you reduce the heat, you increase the life expectancy. It's the opposite of what gamers do, and you get the opposite effect. Gamers cook their processors into death. We will cool ours into longer life. What we're looking at is an E5-2620 Xeon CPU. You guys who want to look it up, look it up. God bless. You know, it's a lot of fun. We're looking at, I'm not sure, between 32 and 64 gig of really good RAM, not the stuff that you'll find on your gamer machines, but stuff you'll find in a server environment. We're using server-class drives. I believe they're 2 terabytes each. And there's not that much data in this system. And the reason there's not that much data in this system is because the nodes are intelligent. It's a question of working smarter versus working harder, but at a computer level. Because that node is taking a look at its sensor readings and deciding not only from its own factors, but from information it's gathering from the MySQL server, it's able to determine what is and what isn't news. What might have started out as filling the bandwidth of the network for half a second or a second to get all the initial program loads made and written and read and all of that, I expect to turn into somewhere between 0 and 10 queries per second during normal operation. That's barely percolating at all. So here's some ingredients we're dealing with. We're dealing with very intelligent nodes in a fairly flat network, all connecting to a MySQL database on a very powerful server running under Red Hat Linux. So the combination is very resilient to things that would make other things fail, very much less likely to fail. We're dealing with macho gear here. And also very, very capable of handling all the load. Now, a friend asked me, well, what if the demand grows? Ha! Not happening. In our cybernetic house, the house isn't growing to need extra sensors. Extra sensors, what are we going to do? Go from 100 to 110? It's not going to be a lot of growth, even if there is some growth. It's a pretty much closed system. So we don't have to do a lot of the things that IT departments have to do. What we have to do is to be logical. And by the way, I'm going to mention something called Navicat. Navicat allows you to prototype, Navicat software, and I've got it on Windows. It allows you to prototype what you're going to do in structuring in any SQL server system, allows you to play with it, look at the data, do queries and that kind of thing without actually doing the whole database. It's a wonderful tool because if you're going to make a mistake, you're doing it in Navicat and not on something that may have tons and tons of data already affiliated with the names and labels and so on that you're using. So this is a little deeper geek than we wanted to go, but I think what you want to take away from this is that by including a relational database as the spine of an automation system, we gain overall awareness, we gain adaptability, we gain a great deal of fault tolerance, and we gain the ability to make every part of it smarter by tapping what every part of it knows. Like everything else, we also have to pay attention to a very important attribute of a MySQL server. And yes, we will backup, backup, backup.
Thank you, Marty.
I thought he was only a hardware person.
Public service announcement. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on cybersecurity. Thursday, November 2nd, 7 p.m. They'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a meeting on Friday, November the 3rd, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on 3D design and printing Tuesday, November the 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, November the 9th at 7 p.m. and the topic of presentation is wireless security cameras that you can install yourself. Presentations at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, November the 10th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of the Harry J. Shore Hall. Princeton PC Users Group will have their meeting on Tuesday, November the 28th. 7 p.m. is the meeting time, and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has their meeting scheduled for Thursday, November the 23rd, 6:45 p.m., and that happens to be Thanksgiving evening, so they may reschedule it the week after. The meeting is at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys December the 5th, which is a Tuesday, at 1:30 p.m., Community Room 999, Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. And all these meetings are open to the public. There's no charge to attend these meetings. And we hope to see you there. And for other club meetings that I might have missed, just let me know at hank@pcradioshow.org and let me know where the meeting is going to be held, what time, what date, and what the topic may be. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup, backup, and, of course, backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and till we meet again, same time, same station next week.